international finance law. We want to understand a typical type of financing transaction. We want to look at the parties involved, the different finance options, the various facility decisions that we can take, as well as the documentation involved and the rights and obligations of all of the parties, and how through that we can allocate loss across the parties and ensure that everyone basically obtains their desired financing and investment objectives, whether it's on the borrower side or on the lending side. In this example, we're going to consider a typical type of project finance exercise. We're going to be building a hotel tower. These hotel towers in Asia have become very popular. The first 40, 50, 60 floors might be commercial real estate, office premises, and then you build the hotel on top of that. So in one facility, you get both a commercial set of offices as well as a hotel on the top as well. So let's look at this and consider the various types of legal issues that might arise, which can assist us understand the various documents and specific clauses or finance options that we need to consider. So your law firm has been instructed to act as the lead bank. So the lead bank, Chase Asia, in connection with the preparation of the financial documentation for the construction of a hotel and office tower in Pudong in Shanghai. Very standard type of example, simply because there was one tower called the Jiangmen Tower or the Park Hyatt. Then they built another hotel tower right beside it called the Park Hyatt. And now they've built a third one right beside it again called the Shanghai Tower. So we're going to construct a third building to be known as, in my example, it's the Tower Hyatt. Is now called the Shanghai Tower in real life, beside the existing Park Hyatts and Grand Hyatts. The development has been designed by a leading firm of international architects, for our example, based in Edinburgh, EA, with construction being headed by a major Hong Kong firm, Hong Kong Constructions. Subcontractors and suppliers will be engaged from all around the world. The lead bank will establish a small syndicate to provide funds to the construction company and its principal subsidiaries. So this is a typical type of syndication situation. We have one borrower, we have other group companies, and we'll have a syndicate of banks making the funds available so that they can spread and manage the credit risk. In this particular case, we're going to raise $200 million in total. We need $100 million for construction costs, $20 million for fitting out, $60 million for land acquisition, $10 million for operating costs, and then another $10 million reserve, which can also be used for operating costs, but it also provides a security and a reserve facility. The total is $200 million. So immediately what we can begin to think is, what type of facility specifically could be used for each of these particular types of funding needs? You're asked to advise on the main finance options available and to prepare initial draft documentation, including specifically in this case, a term sheet. The term sheet is the outline summary of the deal that we will use for initial early negotiation purposes. We will then build that into the final loan agreement once everything has been agreed that we're going to proceed. That will be supported by an information memorandum which summarizes all the background facts to the deal, to the borrowers, to their business activities, to the use and application of the funds, and which will also explain how all of the funds will be repaid in time. So we're going to focus specifically on the terms of the content of the term sheet, which allows us to re-understand, re-examine, revisit, review a typical type of lending structure. Now in this case, additional points have been made. The company's looking for a combination of facilities with separate arrangements for each of the respected phases of land acquisition, construction, fitting out, initial operating costs and reserves. So, what types of options do we have? For the $100 million construction costs and the initial land acquisition, these are long-term committed costs, this is long-term options. The most typical practical solutions will either be a syndicated loan or possibly a long bond. So we're either going to go syndicated loan or long bond. Remember, a bond is for fixed interest period If it's a note, it's floating. Although technically, in practice, what tends to happen, if it's of a longer duration, anything sort of like 20 years plus, we call a bond. Although, strictly speaking, you can have 20, 30, 40, 50 year notes, because if it's floating interest, it's a note. And you can also then have very short bonds, if it's fixed rather than floating. In practical purposes, we tend to consider this in terms of duration. So 20 years plus is a bond. 5, 10, 15, a medium-term note. 1 to 5 years, 1 to 3 or 5, a euro note. Less than 1 year, commercial paper. So what we can do is this. For the land acquisition and the construction, probably syndicated loan. Or maybe a long bond. In practice, usually a syndicated loan. For the other expenses, so for example, fitting out and the reserve, we could use commercial paper. Or no, we could use, sorry, probably a medium-term note or a euro note for those ones, because they're sort of like medium-type facilities. We need them for a period, and we want to repay them over a period. For the operating costs, because that's much shorter, we'll probably go commercial paper. Do you see how this works? We're looking at the nature of the funding, how long it's going to be used and applied, how we're going to repay it, and then trying to come up with the most appropriate financing facility which matches that. Now, let me be clear. In practice, usually for an exercise like this, a tower like this, most commonly it will be a syndicated loan. But even then, they still might have some other additional capital market facilities in there. A medium-term note, a euro note, or a commercial paper. We will then look at the other options. So, what else have we got? We'll see later, if there's any element of risk, we also may build in swaps, and we can look at other types of financing support as well. In this case, it says some of the funds may either be sourced through the lending or bank markets and through the transferable loan bond, the commercial paper market. That's what we've just explained. If we want to provide the most valuable, complete set of options, we would then go for an MOF, a multi-option facility, or an MOFF, a multi-option facility, which principally includes a medium-term note, a commercial paper, probably banker's acceptance, probably short-term advances, and a swing line facility. Swing line facility allows us to borrow very short days, weeks, so that we can move between the other different lending facilities. Now, in this case, it says repayment of all facilities is to be achieved on a non-recourse basis. So this is project finance. In this case, what we're doing is the future income streams from the project are going to pay for the whole of the construction costs and all of the lending and other professional charges and expenses involved. What we will do is we will have a feasibility study conducted whereby we will price all of the costs. We will take the projected future income, we will deduct one from the other, and we will decide, is this viable, and at what price and at what cost. So that's how we'll do this up front. If it is viable, the banks will clearly want to proceed because they can make a very large amount of money out of this. The country and the constructors, they want to proceed because they will have a huge asset. And the point simply is this. All of this is paid from the future income streams generated, either from the lease of the commercial real estate, floors, facilities, in the office sections, or through the use of the hotel in the higher floors of the project. So this is non-recourse. All of this can be done without any initial capital or separate injection of funds. It can all be done on a non-recourse basis. Well, we'll come back and look at this in practice later. Technically, although it's theoretically non-recourse, there's always some form of remedy in practice, so it's kind of partial non-recourse, but we can come back and look at that later. Now, the funds are to be provided in US dollars through, although the construction company may want to convert them into Hong Kong dollars. Now, we already know from our basic examination of a typical term loan facility, such as those provided by the Loan Market Association multi-currency term and revolving facility, that we can have interest options. So LME 9, 9.1, calculation of interest 9.2, 9.3, 9.4. That's the interest periods but we can also have control over the drawdown, allows us to select different currencies. So we can select the currencies when we're selecting the interest period, when we're completing the utilization requests, which are provided for in the Schedule 3 to the documentation. So we already have in the Loan Market Association the ability to select different interest periods and different currencies, which will assist us manage this in practice. If we're going to do this through capital market instruments, either through euro notes or commercial paper, we're also probably going to have to think about a swap, and we'll look at that later. We can either have swap facilities for interest rates, or we can use swap facilities for foreign currency. So we can draw down in different currencies. As the subcontractors, this is point E, and suppliers will be based in a number of other jurisdictions, we need to be able to draw down funds either in principal currencies or in a local currency. So again, it's a similar point. We have the option in the Loan Market Association, the standard syndicated lending facility. If necessary, what will tend to happen is that capital markets will be usually fixed. We can have some multi-currency options, but if necessary, we can support it with a foreign exchange swap. Point F, in the event that the principal currency is converted from US dollars to Hong Kong dollars, it may be that we can get cheaper fixed rate funds in different financial centres. This is where we would use an interest rate swap. Very often what can happen is this. You can draw down in one financial centre at a different time. You can draw down much more cheaply and effectively, either in fixed or floating, and then there'll be the opposite in another financial centre, floating or fixed. In that case, we use swaps. So we can draw down in one currency and then we can swap the interest rate and benefit from the advantage, economic advantage that would be available in one part of the world. We can then use that in another part of the world. That's specifically what interest rate swaps are for. So we can manage foreign currency risk, foreign currency options, and we can manage interest rate advantages and benefits as well. G, the contracting company is still trying to complete an existing commercial building project in Kowloon in Hong Kong, that's on the mainland, although delays have arisen in signing off by the purchaser, who's alleged that some work is faulty. While there has been no formal dispute and no litigation has commenced, this may follow soon. So this is a no litigation clause. We have to consider that in terms of the content of the no litigation representation and warranty that we will provide under our standard syndicated loan agreement. This is particularly included, provided for under LMA 1913. No litigation is intended or imminent or threatened. So what we would need to do is confirm the specific terms of that clause to ensure that we do not breach that, because that would then constitute a misrepresentation, which is an event of default under 23.4. So we need to consider the relationship between 1913 and 23.4. While this may also constitute a separate misleading information statement under 1910. So 1910, 1913, and 23.4. We want to consider all of these together. 1913 specifically provides that no litigation, arbitration, or administrative proceedings before any court, arbitral body, or other agency, which might include a government agency, which, if adversely determined, might reasonably be expected to have a material adverse effect. So material adverse effect is uppercase, so that's a defined term, so we go back and check the specific definition and meaning of material adverse effect. And then it's to the best of its knowledge and belief. Best of knowledge and belief means this. It means that we don't have to make inquiries. We don't have to go and research it. It's do we know at this time? Is there litigation? But then litigation what? Has the litigation either been started or threatened against it in any jurisdiction? So this is very generally drafted. So it's any court, arbitral body or agency. Has it been started or threatened?
if it could have a material adverse effect, we have to disclose that. And if we don't, it's a breach. So we will breach 1913 and 1910, and that will then trigger default under 23.4. So we need to see how all these clauses operate together. In this specific case, there is litigation threatened, so we need to disclose this. And we need to advise the clients to disclose it, or else that will trigger, that will constitute a misrepresentation, and that could trigger default. Chase Asia is also concerned about references to the project work being completed to the highest standards. It's worried about putting this in the information memorandum or prospectus, so information memorandum for the syndicated loan, prospectus for the capital market provisions. The construction company has always worked to the highest standards, and no disputes or litigation exist with regards to defective work, except apart from in relation to the Kowloon project we've already referred to. So in this case, there will be statements confirming that all of the work's carried out to the highest standard, all of the future work will be carried out to the highest standard, but again, that could constitute a material misrepresentation under, what did we say before, 1910. So again, we could breach 1910, which would then constitute an event of default misrepresentation under 23.4. So the no litigation is 1913 and 23.4, but you could also build in misleading information 1910, but again, we can have separate misleading information statements 1910 and 23.4 as events of default. So we need to watch this, we need to be very careful. When you are looking over, when you're checking the information memorandum, you need to ensure that everything is accurate, proper, verifiable, and when it's not, you have to send it back to the client. And if the client can't confirm or prove that it's true, you delete it, because it's just too dangerous otherwise. Chase Asia wishes to ensure that it incurs no liability to the other syndicate members, so Chase Asia is the lead bank, failing to complete the construction properly or in any subsequent disputes. So we need to consider the relationship between the lead bank and the other syndicate members, assuming that the lead bank is independent, but also if the lead bank's also another syndicate member. So this raises the issues that we've talked about before in terms of the nature of the arrangements set up between the members of the syndicate. All of this is set out in the summary documents that I've provided, in particular on loans and then again on bonds. So in terms of the nature of the liability of the syndicate members, we've already mentioned this. This is in LME 2.1, and then the nature of the rights and obligations are in LME 2.2. 2.2, A in brackets, B in brackets, and C in brackets. The obligations are several. The rights are separate and independent, so that we can enforce them separately. We can have separate enforcement again under C. However, that's subject to the sharing clause in 28, and then specifically the exceptions in 28.5. 28.5 provides that if one of the syndicate members is going to take action, if it notifies the others and invites them to participate, they can participate, but if they choose not to, and then that member does generate funds or receipts, it can keep it to itself. Otherwise, it has to share. So we have the general sharing obligation, 28, 1, 2, 3, 4, but there is an exception in 28.5, and we can tie that back to the separate enforcement provision in 2.2c. In terms of the wider relationship between the syndicate members, we have the syndicate democracy, which I deal with in the chapter and in the outline. There was 5 key principles. Severality, everything several. Proportionality, everyone's in proportion to this statement of commitments as set out in the schedule, Schedule 1. Equality, everyone's equal. Democracy, there has to be decisions by a majority or supermajority, or usually consensus, simply because there's limited
delegation of function, and there's limited democratic control. When it comes to important issues like waiver of defaults, adjusting the amounts, the interest, anything like that, it will be on a unanimous basis. There will be no majority voting. There may be some limited majority voting, and even then, if it's there, it will be supermajority, which means not 50%, but 66 2/3%. Principle number 5, then, is limited delegation of function, which corresponds with the limited duties of the agent bank. And there's 5 core sets of duties, which we covered before: receipt duties, payment duties, banking duties, notification duties, and default duties. So we need to consider the relationship between the syndicate members, the relationship between the lead bank, if it's a syndicate member. But then also we can consider the lead bank as an independent institution, apart from assuming it's not a syndicate member, or it's transferred its commitments. And we'll mention that in a couple of minutes. If we're just looking at the lead bank by itself, then we go to the provisions in LME 26. LME 26.3 specifies the role of the arranger, and 26.4 specifies that there's no fiduciary duties. The role of the arranger in 26.3 specifies that the lead bank will assume no obligations to any other party under this facility. And then specifically 26.4, there's no fiduciary relationship or duty of any form. So if we're looking at the lead bank's role and function by itself, we look at the provisions in 26.3 and 4. We can also, at the same time, consider the relationship between the agent bank and the syndicate and the other parties. The agent bank agent bank's role is set out in 26.1, appointment of the agent. The duties are specified, listed in 26.2. We then specifically confirm that there's no fiduciary duty under 26.4, because that applies to both the lead bank and the agent bank. And then we have a range of other clarifications, powers and authorities that the agent bank can exercise or rely on. And then we have the very important exclusion of liability provision in 26.9. which basically specifies that the agent bank can only be held liable in the event of gross negligence. So we can see how all these different provisions fit in again when we're looking at the nature of the relationship between the different parties in the syndicate, as well as between the lead bank and the other banks, and the agent bank and the other banks. The other point I mentioned was this. In practice, very often what will happen is the arranging bank will transfer its commitments, its obligations, even before the facilities come into effect. Why? Because the arranging bank principally makes its money through the lead bank fee, the commitment, the obligation it's entered into by setting the facility up. It gets a large fee as a percentage of the total facility. That's what the lead bank's looking for. That's what it wants. It doesn't actually want to make money by doing the lending. It will advertise, it will tell the other banks it's a member of the syndicate, because that generates support and that encourages other banks to participate. But very often, because it doesn't actually want to generate income from the lending itself, it will transfer the obligation on. And this can be done even before the loan agreement's entered into. So the lead bank, the arranging bank, will either enter into an assignment, legal or equitable, or a novation. Assignments are determined under Section 136 of the Law of Property Act 1925. Section 136 of the Law of Property Act 1925. The assignment has to be in writing for an unconditional amount and with notice to the borrower. In practice, we may or may not want to give notice, but also very often some of the clauses, in particular the grossing up clauses, mean that we'd have an unconditional amount. So even if we wanted to give notice, we still can't have a legal assignment because the amount's unconditional, because we don't know what it will be until certain clauses have been triggered or exercised. So in practice, we're looking at equitable assignment. And I've provided a separate short summary note on this. In this case, if the lead bank wants to transfer the obligation to lend, you can only assign benefits if you're transferring obligations, it has to be a novation. A novation cancels the commitment and then re-executes it between the new parties that are involved. All of this is provided for. We have the provisions on change of lenders in 24, change of obligors in 25, LMA. So we've got assignments and transfers, 24.1. We have a specific form of transfer certificate in Schedule 5, which is a novation. Under the new LMA, Schedule 6, we also have a separate assignment. In this case, it will be a novation because we want to transfer benefits and rights as well as obligations. So, in terms of actually considering the documentation and drafting then, we have some further specific directions. So, we've got the term sheet. We have to include standard financial terms, obligations, conditions precedent, representations and warranties, covenants, and then the defaults. So the three key sets of provisions are the financials, the obligations and the defaults. And the obligations consist of the CPs, conditions precedent, reps and W, the representations and warranties, and then the covs, the covenants. And I've explained all of this in detail in the chapter provided and in the summary documents made available. We then need to consider the different facilities, the alternative currency options, the need for any separate currency or interest rate mechanisms. That would be the swaps. We outline any quality of work provision. We outline any separate indemnities to the lead manager and separate indemnities to the agent bank, any further collateral guarantees or other credit support. We list the main accounts. And then we consider any other documents which are going to be entered into and executed. What I have then provided is this. I've got a sample term sheet which can illustrate how a number of these provisions will be given effect to in practice. Now, this specific example is similar but not identical to the exercise that we've just set up. It's not going to be the tower as such. In this case, I think it's construction projects for, I think, motorway systems in the Middle East. But it's very similar. A number of the same issues arise. So if we go through this very briefly, we can begin to see how we identify key issues, legal points, financial and economic points, and how we build all of this together, initially in the term sheet itself, and then that will become the final loan document and the loan agreement following negotiation. So let's have a look at this term sheet. We have the type and amount of credit facility. We have the purpose. Very often in standard Euroloan documents, there is a provision for purpose in the LMA in clause 3.1 for general vanilla international loans. We do not actually fill that out. We do not have a particular purpose. It's just left open. If it's a project finance deal, we will have a purpose because the funds can only be used to support this particular specific project. So in these deals, we will have a purpose, and this will be quite detailed because we want to ensure that the company, in this case, a special purpose vehicle, which is a shell company and a shelf company set up in an offshore financial centre, only can enter into this transaction for this purpose and build this project. We don't want it doing anything else, so we're going to narrow its objectives. We want to control its directors and shareholders. We want to ensure that it's only able and it only focuses on the delivery of the completion, execution and performance of this contract alone. We have the borrower. We're going to specify the borrower's controllers, because this will be an element of the credit assessment exercise that we will enter into. We need to know the sponsors who are basically designing and setting up the project. In this particular case, we will then have a separate contractor, although the contractor may be one of the sponsors. We're going to have the lead arranger, which is the lead bank setting up the facility, who in this case is also lead underwriter. We will have the lenders, that's the lending group. We'll have a separate facility agent, that's the agent bank. We'll have a security trustee who's going to hold any assets in trust on behalf of the lending banks. And then we'll have a separate technical and modelling
agent. We have the syndication agent. We have that's counsel for the lenders, counsel for the borrowers, and then an independent consultant as well, because it's quite a complex, large deal. We'll also have a separate technical consultant. So there's a lender's independent technical consultant who will provide technical advice on the nature and completion of the projects. They will probably have been involved in preparing the feasibility study, which assesses, calculates to what extent the future income stream will be sufficient to cover all of the costs involved. Availability. We're going to specify the availability period and then any conditions tied to availability. This is specifically set out in the utilisation provisions in the LMA. So we can see the conditions for utilisation in 4 and specifically 4.1, which direct that the initial conditions precedent must have been satisfied. And then we have the conditions precedent set out in Schedule 2. So this is how we incorporate the conditions precedent into a standard international loan agreement. This just contains the availability conditions. Separately, it specifies them in the term sheet, which will then be built into the final loan agreement. We're going to have conditions precedent to initial drawing, and these all seem quite standard in practice. If we just look at these. So we've got executed financing and security documentation, project documentation, a satisfactory audited project model, which will confirm again the economic viability of the project over time, copies of board resolutions, evidence satisfactory to the lenders has been appropriately capitalised, so there's enough capital for the sponsors and the company concerned, all necessary government approvals have been obtained. Very often in these large deals, you're actually dealing with the government directly. In this case, it's in the Middle East. Very often, you will be involved directly with the government, with the sheikh or whoever else is behind the ruler in the country. Very often, what you will find is, and this certainly happened at early stages in a lot of these construction areas, basically when they found a lot of the early oil wells and they started to build the oil extraction facilities, and then the refineries, what they found out was a lot of the laws weren't in place to do a lot of key things, including, for example, take security. And what actually happened was the lawyers involved with setting up the deals were actually helping the government draft laws to go through the parliament or the parliamentary process to have them approved so the laws could actually be in place to allow for the legal documentation to actually work in practice. That's when this becomes very interesting, very exciting. And this still happens in a lot of countries. There may be specific types of, for example, a floating charge, particular types of security, or there may be specific facilities, for example, a repurchase agreement. The law do not recognise this, the host countries do not recognise this, so you actually have to assist and bring this into effect. Any other satisfactory evidence with regards to the equity of the sponsors, and then any other subordinated debt arrangements. We've then got standard clauses on interest rate. So it's going to be the local interbank offered rate plus the margin, and we'll direct the margin separately. Interest periods will either be 1, 3, or 6 months. The margin in this case is 200 basis points. It's 2%. 2% on top of the cost of borrowing, which is the local interbank offered rate. Now, if this is a London facility, that would be SONIA, the sterling overnight rate, specified by the Bank of England. It was LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, which is provided for here. Now it would be SONIA. And then whatever the local interbank offered rate is in any of the local financial centres where the funds are being obtained. So we'll see here the margin is 200%, although it's going to increase years 1 to 10, 1.5, years 11 to 20, 1.75, and then it's going to rise to 200 basis points for the rest of the facility. Why? Because as we're setting things up, there's not going to be a lot of income coming in. There's going to be larger income in future, so the interest rate will go up over time. So that's why we have to stage the margin process. The commitment commission, that's on undrawn amounts. So each of the banks making the funds available, until the funds are drawn down,
they will receive 100 basis points, 1%. So that's the availability fee for making the funds available. Once the funds are drawn down, then they get the margin. So until the funds are drawn down, they get 100 basis points. Once they're drawn down, they get up to 200 basis points. What we'll see is any undrawn amounts after the availability period, they will be cancelled. You'll see that above under availability at the top of the page, top left. The commitment commission, that's the 1%. You'll just see in the notes there, very often the availability fee is 40% of the margin. So that would be a kind of standard market figure. You would just look at that in terms of negotiation. You'll see that in the notes provided. Front-end fees. The lead bank will receive a work fee and then other front-end fees. In this case, it's going to be 0.8%. So what's the total facility? Whatever the total facility is, it's going to receive 8% of the full amount, which is 380 million. So the fee for this is 80 basis points. Project completion. We're going to define and have conditions with regards to the satisfaction of certain performance conditions. The final maturity date, when everything has to be repaid, is in this case 2039. We can have early repayment and we can have mandatory prepayment. We will see if there's prepayment, there's an additional fee. So the additional charge for the prepayment is an extra 50 basis points, 0.5%. Mandatory prepayment, this is important in these large complex projects, especially where we have sovereign borrowers, sovereign parties involved. If there's any expropriation, any nationalisation or any confiscation, everything's cancelled. That automatically constitutes mandatory prepayment. All of the funds have to be repaid immediately. And you'll ensure all of these clauses are in place. Hedging, we'll have hedging instruments to manage any risk, any borrowing risk, foreign currency risk, interest rate risk. We then have the standard representations and warranties, so the borrower is properly constituted, proper authorisations, documentations binding and enforceable, all necessary public and other government permissions have been obtained. No material litigation, so this is LMA 1913. No material default on any other provisions. So this is a statement of representation which will then be tied to the cross default. And then all the security documents are in place and provide appropriate priority. Other information is proper, legitimate, and then no material adverse event. So an MAE clause. We then have the covenants. Now in this case it's slightly unusual. We've got positive covenants and negative covenants. That's not followed in the LMA, but this is quite useful as we can see how this is applied in different ways in practice. Positive covenants, maintenance of approvals, permanence and consents, laws and regulations, concession, documentation enforced. Do you see how these repeat each other? So the covenants are supporting the representations and warranties. Construction and operation is in accordance with good industry practice. Audited financial statements have been provided within 2 months, and then other standard clauses. The negative covenants, this is where we can exercise a lot of control over the borrowers and the borrower's activities. So we've got limitations on additional debt. In this case, limitations on the creation of new subsidiaries. Very often, if this is done through a special purpose vehicle, we want the special purpose vehicle to be insulated on its own. We need to know who owns it and we need to control its activities, either with subsidiaries, controllers or disposal of assets. So we're going to watch all of these activities and we can control that through specific provisions, in particular in the CUS. And then you've got a standard negative pledge clause. The project documents are not materially amended, terminated or waived. There's prohibitions on transactions with affiliates, prohibition on making dividends or other distributions unless it's above certain financial ratios as specified. And then we've got the events of default, again standard defaults, non-payment, breach of reps, W's, breach of CUVs, material default, that's the MAC clause, liquidation or administration, non-enforceability, security becomes unenforceable, termination of the concession, other events, and then breach of specific financial ratios. We've then got the control accounts. This becomes important in these large complex deals.
We need to manage the use and application of funds that we've made available, as well as the use and application of the income that's going to come in subsequently. So you'll see here that we have got, so there's the, that's the hedging, reps and W's, that's the CUVs, negative CUVs, events of defaults. So we've got the control accounts. We have a revenue account, we have a maintenance reserve account, we have a debt service reserve account, we have a compensation account and a distribution account. Each of those is explained in the text. We've then got security. In these types of deals, we take security over everything in favour of the lenders to protect their interests. So you will take security over all of the plant, all of the land, all of the machinery and equipment. You take security over all of the legal documents, all of the rights of, under the documentation, all of the accounts, even the insurance policies and the right to payment under the insurance policies. Every type of security instrument you can imagine, from mortgages, debentures, floating charges, pledges, liens, you will use all of these to protect the interests of the banks so that the banks can lend the funds available and do so on a reasonable, secure basis. Because if you can do that, you keep the cost of borrowing down. If there's concerns with any of these, the cost of borrowing will go up. We have a standard governing law clause. We have the mandate letter, which we'll take at the very beginning, and then other miscellaneous provisions. In the schedule, so there's the mandate letter, miscellaneous provisions. In the schedule, we've got the target completion date. We've got the final permitted date. If we don't complete by then, that'll be a breach of default, an event of default. Then we've got the specific key financial ratios. In this case, it's the annual debt service cover ratio, the ADSCR, and just below, the cash flow available for debt service, the CADS. We can have a very significant amount of control over the activities of the borrower, and again, to protect the interests of the lenders by managing these ratios. We don't want to get involved with the day-to-day business of the borrower, because otherwise we could constitute shadow directors. If there's any error and any loss incurred, we could become liable if we're shadow directors. So we don't get involved with the day-to-day decision-taking, but through the use of these financial covenants, we can exercise a very significant amount of control. Because the borrowers have to carefully manage their own activities to stay within these specific ratios. So through a carefully structured set of even one or two, but in complex deals more, five, even ten ratios, we can have substantial monitoring function as well as control over the activities of the borrowers to protect the lender's commitments. The majority lenders, in this case it's a two-thirds majority, if there's any majority voting permitted. We're going to define a material adverse event. We list the key project documents, and then we specify the project model, which sets up the cash flow as part of the feasibility study to determine that there's going to be sufficient income brought in to manage all of the commitments which are going to be generated, created, so that we can ensure that the income from the project will be sufficient to pay all of the borrowing and construction costs involved. So with that, what we can do is understand how a standard term sheet is structured and drafted. It's basically a mini loan agreement. All we're simply doing is directing, specifying the content of the key clauses that we would include. All that happened in this exercise was, that was your model, your template, and all you were expected to do was reuse that and draft that to reflect the specific terms and conditions that we needed for the particular project that we've designed with the construction of this hotel office tower in Pudong, Shanghai. And with that, we can understand all of the key financing options, the principal core legal issues that arise, the key documents and the key clauses that we need to consider, and how we would negotiate and draft and include those in the final set of documents put together to ensure that we can deliver on all of the parties' objectives and complete and perform the particular project committed to.